So, midterm review today. Hopefully, you get the pun. A kind of a test. Hard protective shell. The Bruegel assignment and the comprehension assignment are both still due Sunday. The lockdown browser compliance test. Please try to do that, as soon as possible, so that you know that your lockdown browser is working fine. So once you do that, then you'll get access to the midterm. Module which has in it the midterm, which will be made available next week on a date that we'll determine once we kind of vote here on preferences here on exactly how many days and which days. We'll get to that in just a second. So today we're going to do this midterm review. Then stage one will be on Tuesday, and I'll emphasize this on the next slide. And then stage two will be on Thursday, stage one individual and stage two group. So the basic idea here is that in general, the midterm is going to be about 35 to 40 points distributed over questions that will include partial credit to the most that Canvas allows me to do. So if the Canvas gives me an option to check the partial credit box, I will do so. And I'll try to choose questions that if there's an alternative form that has partial credit, I'll try to turn choose, or I have been trying to choose those. And questions are selected to assess the learning outcomes at the top of each study guide. So now, if you have access to the midterm module because you're taking the lockdown browser test, you can find there's like a study guide for all four units, which basically just links to the study guides for all the individual units. But at the top of each one of those, it says like what you should know in this unit. Those are the things like each one of those bullets. I go through there and say, well, let me pick a sample of these for this unit. Let me design a question that helps assess this particular topic. And that might be a low order question, like, a definitional question that might be a little bit more higher order, where it might give you an example and then ask you to sort of think about the meaning of that example. So automatically graded. So there's no essay questions or anything. I might ask you to type in a word or something like that, and I'll be sure to use very permissive or grading, generous grading on spelling and things like that, again, to the extent that Canvas allows. As generally for both phases, you can come to class. I will be here Tuesday and Thursday at this time. You don't have to be. So if you have travel plans for fall break or whatever, or you just don't want to take the exam here, you don't have to come here for the exam stages, but you can. I will be here, and you're welcome to take the individual version here. Bring a laptop, likewise with the group, bring a laptop. So, and then the details of that is for stage one. That's a lockdown browser. So you get one sheet of notes, you get scrap paper. The notes may be digitally produced. So you can type them out, you can draw them, but I just don't want them to be copies or screen captures of existing content that you didn't produce. So don't copy figures out of the textbook or elsewhere. It just has to be all you produce stuff. And the tip here is at the, do bring scrap paper or, and at the end of your exam, before you hit submit, just record your answers. Just, for even if you don't. I wouldn't record a letter answer because these things get randomized, but some identifier, you could say that like the numbering should be the same between stage one and stage two, so that you know that, okay, so question six about, I don't know, levels of explanation or something like that, I answered phylogeny or something like that. And then so if you have all those, then you'll have kind of a warm start. When you go into the group one or the stage two, you'll know that, okay, I remember I answered phylogeny for this one, but is that the right answer or something along those lines? So, or that just gives you a chance to kind of go back through that and say, I really feel less confident about this one over this one. So I definitely recommend, it's just a tip, you don't have to do it, but since you've got the scrap paper, since I'm providing that, you may as well write down your answers at the end of it, and that's totally fine to do. I won't give you your scores or answers between the stages. So then Thursday you come in, you won't know how well you did on stage one. You won't know the answers on stage one, but you will know the questions from stage one because these will be the same questions that you use for stage two. But stage two will be open book, open notes, open Canvas. No lockdown browser. You can collaborate with other students currently enrolled in the class. You can do that here in class. You can just talk. We can be, it doesn't have to be quiet during stage two. You can group together. When I do these, sometimes I get these sort of self or organized groups. I'm not assigning groups. You can group with whoever, or you don't have to group at all. You could just do it totally individually. You could just, if you've got all your answers from stage one, you could just go down through, fill them all in for stage two, hit submit, and get the same score on stage two that you did stage one and be done with it. That's totally fine. So it's totally up to you how you want to make use of this stage two. If you are doing it remotely, I saw that hand in a second. If you are doing it remotely, you could definitely feel free to use Slack, Discord, or other tools. But if it is something where there's public information, where there's other people on that channel, everybody who's on that channel should be someone who is enrolled in the course this semester. So no collaborating with people outside the course. And I saw that hand too, so I'll get to you guys in just a second. And then if you are going to say set up a Discord because you just feel like you'd rather have something separate or whatever, Anushka and I are not going to join your channel. So, but if you want sort of a separate channel, if you feel comfortable with it, feel free to post, your Discord channel or wherever you're going to fill in Slack in the official Canvas Slack or Canvas discuss, or sorry, official course Slack or Canvas discussion boards or whatever, if you want other people to know about that, so you can join that. And again, Anushka and I are not going to join as, as fake students or anything like that. I trust you that you know what the rules are, and I hope that you will abide by the rules, and that's sort of that. But again, you don't have to collaborate. Your group is totally up to you. If you just want to do this on your own, that's totally fine too. There was a question earlier. Yeah, these, I would say, 8.5 by 11 or A4. Did I get that right? A4.
Maybe a blank.
Yeah, but just a blank sheet of paper, like printer paper or loose leaf paper. And then, yeah, you can write on the front. Basically, when you do the lockdown, you're going to show it your formula sheet back in front, and then any other paper on your desk, you're going to show that they're blank. If you want to, I don't think you're going to need a calculator. So I almost feel confident to say that I don't want to allow calculators just because if you have a calculator there on this particular exam, the worry is that it's there for some other reason. Because I mean, I don't have a problem, but I can tell you right now that I'm not going to ask you to do any calculations on the exam. No, so you're going to show the camera on stage one, your sheets, so you don't have to turn anything in. So between stage one and stage two, you retain all that paperwork yourself. So you go into stage two with your formula sheet or note sheet and with any of those scrap pieces of paper that you can are free to use then on stage two. So I am trusting that because the availability window, which we haven't talked about that yet, but stage one is timed. So I'll give you 90 minutes for stage one. You can start at any time during the availability window. We're going to vote here in a second on what your preferences are going to be for when that availability opens. But you will at least have all Tuesday for stage one and at least have all Thursday for stage two. So if you start it, you could start stage one in the morning on Tuesday and be done with it. And now you've seen the exam. I'm trusting that there's not a whole lot of sharing that's going to go on between people who took the exam and those who took it, who get it later, because those who get it later then get sort of like an unfair advantage. And so that would be academic misconduct. So I'm assuming that you're not going to do that sharing. That's why I want you to have those sheets of paper. I'm trusting you as adults to use those sheets of paper in a sort of an honest way. And so I would rather you have them than have you like drop them off at my office or something like that. But along with that, I am definitely trusting you to not like write down all the questions and then give them to a friend of yours or someone else in the class that then takes it later in the day and they score really well, even though you may not have scored as well. So that's kind of the idea there. Question?
A real up to you.
Oh, yeah. So I mean, I think that there has been research that's shown that it's better for you, for your memory, to actually type it all out as opposed to highlight, Apple C, Apple V. But I mean, I'm not gonna, I'm allowing you to type it out, so there's no way I can tell the difference between you copying text and pasting text and typing it out. I would just recommend that you type it out. But yeah, I mean, what I'm really looking for is that, like, I just don't want to see a copy of a Breed textbook, like that, like all of the key terms from the Breed boxes, because I can understand it might be convenient to just snapshot, snapshot, snapshot. But usually the way these things work is if you make a good formula sheet or note sheet, you end up not having to use it that much because the process of making it ends up consolidating a lot of that information. So I'm just trying to sort of give you an extra incentive to do the studying ahead of time rather than kind of leaning on screen captures as a crutch that you then try to then search through later. Yep. So that's a good point. The book is meant to complement the slides. The book is meant to say, like, if Ted didn't say something in a way that was very clear to me, and I talked to Anushka, and for some reason, that also doesn't helping, then I've got the book that and let's see how Breed and Moore say it. And so if there you will find, just because they pack a lot, all animal behavior textbooks are like this. They pack a lot into each chapter. You may say, like, well, I covered a lot, there's a lot of terms or whatever, but I had to skip a lot that was covered. And so there will be things, I add examples that they don't have, but most of the terminology they go over to phenomena that I just didn't have time to cover. I'm not expecting you to know stuff that I haven't covered up here. So use the book to help you. But don't view the book as an additional obstacle that you have to get around for this test. I would definitely recommend, like I said, looking at these study guides at the top of each one of these four units, and then based on those, say, do I know how to do this particular thing? Do I know the difference between mechanism and function? That sort of thing. The stage one is timed. So you'll start it, and whenever you start it, you get a 90-minute timer. So if you started in here, there doesn't appear to be a class that comes in after this. So I'm willing to hang out for those of you who want to come to class on Tuesday during this time period and just spend 90 minutes instead of 75 minutes here. I'm willing to spend extra time here just so that you can have that full 90 minutes. Otherwise, wherever you start it, you get the 90 minutes. You just have to complete it before the availability window closes. This portion is not. This portion, you just have to submit it before the availability window closes. But you can just leave it up and you don't hit submit. Or if you hit submit, you can go back and I'll make it so that you can submit again and it will take your latest version, not your highest version. But so I would recommend that for your stage two, just leave it open. And then if your availability window hits, I think it automatically submits. But then that way you can go back and adjust to those things as you sort of like, you might fill it out on, let's say, Thursday, and then you talk to somebody Thursday afternoon. So then Friday you make some changes and that's totally fine. Other questions about the structure here before we get to figuring out when it'll be available? Okay, so let's. So what I'm gonna use iClicker to pull what your preference will be. Let me go over the options and explain why I recommend option A, and then I'll open the poll. So these are the four different ways I could open the two stages next week. These two, they open on Monday. And these two, they don't open on Monday. So why might you choose these ones? If you think that you want to reach out to those of us who've seen the exam, like me and Anushka, to ask questions, it puts us in a difficult spot if you ask us content questions when the exam's already out, because we aren't going to be sure if you genuinely have a question or you've heard from someone else that there's a particular question about a particular topic and you're trying to get us to give the right answer out. And so it puts us in an awkward spot because it sounds like a good question, but it also sounds like it could be something where you're trying to get us to admit an answer that we've seen. So If you want Monday to email us with questions or reach out or contact us in any particular way with questions about content, then these are the two options for you. But if you'd rather have flexibility and availability and extra time, then these are the two options. Now, what are the differences here and why do I recommend A? So option A is stage one opens Monday, like at midnight, like late night, Sunday night. And is open all day Monday, all day Tuesday, and would close like Wednesday at 10 a.m. And then stage two would open up right after stage one closes. And then you would have stage two the rest of Wednesday, all of Thursday, all of Friday, all of Saturday, and would close like early Sunday morning. And so the reason I recommend this one is that fall break's coming up, and there will be some of you who have travel plans at the end of this week. Not all of you, but some of you. And some of you might have put your travel plans in the middle of Thursday. Just that's how it worked out. And so this option here will allow those people a little bit more flexibility to get their two stages, done before they leave town so they don't have to worry about it. It's not that big of a deal, but for me, I don't really care. But that's the reason why I might argue for A gives you plenty of time to do stage one, gives a lot of time to do stage two, and then it also allows you to get stage two out of the way so that you can kind of start fall break a little sooner. So that's why I would argue for A. The difference between A and B, we've just taken Wednesday and popped it up into stage one. So that way you get 3 days for both stages. That's totally fine, but then you have to start stage two on Thursday, and if Thursday is a travel day for you, then that means that you'll be finishing stage two wherever you're going. And then, like I said, these are a mimic of these, but we've just popped Monday off. So, any questions about these options? I don't care. So, I what and I again, I have preferences, so I'm going to use this. I'm going to use the iClicker just to get your preferences. It's not binding, so I'm still just going to incorporate this into my choices. Yep. Well, I mean, so the question was, do we respond on weekends? I guess technically, I mean, if you want to be. So I'm paid for 8 hours a week to work on this course, but it takes me about 12 hours per lecture. So I mean, already I'm over the eight. So if you send me a note on the weekend, I may not be able to get back to you immediately, but I'm probably going to be a sucker and get back to you before Monday. I'm not guaranteeing I can get back to you within a half hour or something like that, but I know that there's an exam coming up. I actually my wife is getting an award on Friday, so we have to travel to Ohio Friday morning. So I won't be able to like, all of Friday I'll be traveling and then at that banquet. But then like Saturday just sort of spending time up there while she visits with her. So I'll have like all of Saturday off and then we fly back Sunday. So I can't say that I've got a lot of flexibility, but definitely Saturday, there's plenty of time that if you send especially something quick that I can respond to over a cell phone or whatever, I'd be definitely happy to do that. So and then so yeah, if you set I don't have as a strict rule, especially given that a midterm would be open up Monday that I won't respond to you over the weekend. I just can't guarantee it'll be within a half hour or something like that. All right, so looks like we've got 60 people voted. So I'll just leave this. I'm just gonna leave this up and open. This is the only iClicker poll the whole today. And I'm actually going to, what I'm going to do is I'll take this polling results after class and I'll look at them and decide how we're going to open up the availability or whatever. But then basically I'm going to give everybody a free pass on attendance for today because this day is for you. So if you don't need any review, if this is not a useful time, if you got other things to do, it's 5 o'clock or whatever, It won't hurt my feelings if you want to leave. Otherwise, I'm happy to go through, answer questions, and to go through the slides that I've got here, which are kind of the highlights of the four units that we've gone through. But at any time, you say, you know what, I feel like I got it from here. You can feel free to leave. And there are no more eye clickers for the rest of today. So I'm going to leave this eye clicker poll open so that throughout while you're here, you can feel free to change your response. So, any questions before I go? So, like the next slide here, I'm just going to go back to Unit A and say, hey, remember Unit A? These are what I thought the highlights would be. But before we get there, I want to make sure that there's specific questions that anybody has already. And these slides, this little compilation is in the midterm module on Canvas. So, you know, if you want to look through these slides, they have been uploaded to Canvas. I have added a terms to Unit A. I will see if I can, you know, get time to do it for B and C as well. So, all right. So if any questions, yeah, go ahead. The cladogram, cladogram. Yeah, I would say that we had a brief example in Unit A and in Unit B. In Unit A, where we saw a chronogram, in Unit B, where we saw a cladogram. And the big difference between them is they both are phylogenetic trees, but one of them kind of depicts time and the other one's just those branching relationships. And I would just say because we are interested in evolutionary explanations, you should know how to read one of those if I were to sort of show one of those to you and make some inferences out of it. This is not a course on systematics or you know, a course on even your pure evolution. So like I'm not going to ask you a lot of I'm not going to ask you to build one, you know, those sorts of things. But you should just be, you know, if we say, you know, there's we're trying to test a phylogenetic explanation, then you know, a phylogenetic tree might be a part of that question. Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, so the so the so the point was that students had questions about interpreting the cladogram, and I actually don't know if we've it might be in Unit B. It's such a not that important topic to me for this course that I'm not sure if I've even highlighted it, which should give you hints as to the intent here. I'm just scrolling through the highlighted slides I have to see if I've got an example from what I think Unit B is where we did the. There was a chronogram in the highlights, I think, for Unit A. So I guess that would be similar. So page 8 of the highlights. This is what I have for my page 8. It's possible that, so I did update these with these terms pages. Chronogram, right. Right. So what, I mean, what I really want, I mean, the big things when you're looking at one of these trees that I want you to get is that these members down here are more closely related because they branch closer than since say this, it's about comparison. So this one is more closely related to this one than this one is to say one of these way over here, which, you know, farther back in history, there was an ancestor that they forked off from. And so we if I were to show you something like this, and then I were to say, like, show you a bunch of typically the way it goes is somebody gives us this based on molecular data. Someone else goes into a lab, they look at DNA sequences, and they figure out that these 15 species of birds or something like that have this relationship. So that these two birds are relatively closely related, they have a common ancestor that's not that far back in history. These two are not so much. Their common ancestor is much farther back. And then I could say across these birds, is there a behavioral phenotype? And you could say for this bird, we see, one phenotype, and then it repeats over here, and then it's also over here. And that might be, one comparison versus like, well, if we see that these two birds are the only ones with this particular trait, and all the rest have some other trait, then that sort of gives me a lot of confidence that, well, the common ester of these two birds, that's where that trait popped up, and then these two inherited from it. As opposed to if the trait is kind of across this whole group, then that might just be a trait that was more likely to be very sort of ancestral and was maybe lost in the ones that don't have it. Those are the types of inferences that I'd hope that you can look at these things and kind of make. But I guess I should say, now that I've sort of gone through that example, are there specific questions about how to interpret this tree? And the only difference in chronogram and cladogram for this class that we care about is that a chronogram allows you to not only look at how these things relate to each other, but to sort of guess at how far the common ancestor goes back, and then use, say, information from geologic data, or other sorts of things that sort of says what event might have caused, like in this particular case, there was about butterflies, and this huge diversity of butterflies exploding after flowering plants become a thing. So it's like, which came first? Did you get diverse butterflies and that led to diverse plants, or did you get diverse plants and that led to diverse butterflies? And this sort of suggests, given that most of the fossil evidence is after the plants pop up, and that's what these green dots are, the fossil evidence, then they kind of suggest that the plants came first and that drove diversification in the butterflies. That was this example. So are there any specific questions about using these phylogenies to summarize these hypotheses? I would say that if you have that is not terminology that I'm testing you on. If you have that toolkit available to you from your other coursework, it certainly is going to make it easier to read these things. But I am not requiring that level of comprehension. So, any other questions about this kind of? So in this particular case, these, if we look down here at this legend, it says the blue is angiosperm radiation. Does anybody know what an angiosperm is? Flowering plant. That's right. So that's a fancy name for flowering plant. So what they're saying is that based on fossil evidence and geological evidence and evidence from other phylogenies and other things like that, evidence that's not shown here, they're saying that you had a flowering plants around this long ago. So this is 100 million years ago, right? So then this is when you got a lot of flowering plants in this area here. And so they're just saying here that based on other evidence from, this is when you got the rapid diversification of flowering plants. Before that point, the only fossil evidence we had was sort of these, the sort of basic. Well, there was like one butterfly that you can find in the fossil record, and then these sister groups. And so these X's here are questionable findings. So the authors here are saying they're skeptical that these fossil records are real or in the right point. So then they point out that all the other fossil evidence of butterflies occurred much more recently. So it seems like there's a division. There was like one butterfly, flowering plants, and then there were a whole bunch of butterflies. That's how I'm interpreting this. Okay. Any other questions about phylogenies, evolutionary relationships? All right. So then going back here, like I said, at Unit A, So yeah, this is, if you haven't ever clicked on, if you click on those study guides, this is what it looks like. I'm not going to go over this now, but that study guide at the top of Unit A has this little phrase like, by the end of this unit, students will be able to describe the relationship between a causal question, a hypothesis, an experiment, and a prediction. So you say, I feel like I understand how all those go together. Check. I'll move on and study the next thing. You know, and so on. So these bullets, the by the end of this unit, those are the bullets I think you should study. And then after you feel confident about those, then scan the list of important terms and say, do I remember these terms and how they relate to these things? And if you feel confident about these terms and those bullets, I think you're going to be in good shape. And in Unit A, I've added a term a definition list here, just like I did in Unit D. If I get a chance, maybe tonight, between packing and things, then I'll try to put one together for units B and C as well. But this is just meant to be a quick reference for all the terms that were brought up in that. But on this study guide, what I clipped out here is beneath here, it has all it. Oh, I think actually, no, I've reformatted it. So now on the Canvas version, the important terms have actually broken out by lecture. So it says the important terms from lecture A1 are these, from lecture A2 are these. So, and that's already done in all the units. So if there's a term that you don't remember, and I haven't built this, just go to that and it'll tell you which lecture to find that in, then scan through that lecture for those dashed boxes, which I try to use on almost all of the terms. And then that'll give you that definition. So it's a little less quick as this, but you should be able to find it. The big things from that first unit, behavioral ecology, an introduction to behavioral ecology, and Timbergen's four. Like we just love Timbergen's four and animal behavior, and so know these four, what they are, how they're different, how the sort of different explanations are, the whys, the two hows. So the proximate versus the ultimate, which is kind of put here, where this is the ultimate and it goes down through this sieve down to the proximate. This is definitely an important concept that you should know very well coming out of this class. And then also know, we talk about causal questions and explanations. Explanations are hypotheses. So we really want to be clear that we're using these terms correctly. So know that a hypothesis is an answer to a question, and a prediction is the if then. So a hypothesis never starts with if then. You take a hypothesis with an experiment to create a prediction. You say if this hypothesis under this hypothesis, if I did this experiment up here, then I would predict that I get a certain outcome. And then if you don't get that outcome, then you maybe get rid of this hypothesis and go to a different hypothesis. So that idea of the relationship between experiment prediction and hypothesis is also very important because a big part of animal behavior is differentiating like between the different causal levels and the different explanations. So a behavior can be here for mechanistic reasons, like that's how it works, but also can be here for evolutionary reasons. Or for ultimate, for a functional reasons. And then also can be inherited, like can be evolutionary baggage. So like understanding, we have to know sort of all of those sorts of things. And that's why it's important to know how hypothesis fits into all of this. So scientific process stuff. And then the other half of Unit A was this kind of defining behavioral ecology, and how it's built from behaviorism and ethology. This umwelt idea, really important. And then these evolutionary forces. So, the things that change the frequency of alleles in a population is not just natural selection, it's also genetic drift, mutation, and migration. Know that these two, selection and drift, get rid of genetic variation. So they reduce heritability. That's a term that will come up in the next unit. And these ones add variation. They diversify. So, those are important topics, and that's what these couple of slides go over. So, the behaviorism versus ethology. Behaviorism is largely about learning in the lab. Ethology is largely about innate behaviors in their natural environment. The umwelt, important term. And then the fact that we really do in behavior It's not just about watching things run around. We really need to know what's going on inside the animal, the hormones and the pheromones, the physiology, like as you saw with that cricket paper, if you read that, how costly the behaviors are, that actually matters. Like measuring that, wow, when you have this type of call in a cricket, it is like an order of magnitude more energetically costly than this other type of call. That really matters when we're analyzing why those behaviors are here. The neuroscience, sort of what is it possible for this thing to even learn and how is it learning and how costly is the learning? And then the sensory biology, the umwelt, what can this animal even sense? So all of those things matter. And they're all examples of different mechanistic pathways that we need to think about when we talk about mechanisms that implement behaviors. So that was kind of what we got out of that. And then, going, this is sort of just, mentioning again these forces, natural selection, genetic drift, reducing diversity, and then mutation and migration, increasing diversity. So, any questions about Unit A or Unit B? I'm sorry, this is all Unit A. Any questions about Unit A, the foundations of kind of just basic animal behavior in Timbergen's 4? Timbergen's 4, super important. Okay. Yep, sorry.
Back at the spider museum.
I mean, there was nothing really. I mean, this was just this is something Breed put together, this is just saying that when we talk about behavior, that you might not think that people who study sensory biology are you think that might be a different camp. And this is just saying, you don't need to. There's nothing about this diagram that's important, but it's more that like endocrinology or endocrinology is not that it's not it, you wouldn't think necessarily that, oh, that has anything to do with behavior. That's about, that these metabolites floating around in the bloodstream and hormones and all of that. But actually, in order to understand what's going on in behavior, it's really useful to also know what's going on inside the animal. And so that's all we're sort of saying is that you might think these are four separate boxes that have nothing to do with behavior. And behavior is all about just putting animals in a cage and watching them move from one side of the cage to the other. But in order to really, really understand how that behavior works and where it comes from, we really do need to call on our colleagues in these other areas. That's all this is communicating. Yeah, just the behavior isn't, you might say that's not behavior, that's neuroscience. Like they're like coloration or whatever. Like I might tell you that in order for a bird to show a bright white red streak on its back, it needs to be able to eat a very rare but very important berry in the forest. And you might say, how does that have anything to do with behavior? Like going from berry to carotenoid to the red streak. Well, hopefully, now that we've talked about communication, you could see that, oh, but that conspicuous red streak actually provides information to other birds about the ability of that bird to find that resource. So, on one hand, the physiologists out there are might be interested in just how that red pattern forms, and that's not a behavioral question. But why that red pattern is conspicuous, is visible, that is a behavioral question. And what it means, the fitness value of that red stripe right there, because it means that that animal could find that resource, that is a behavioral question. So that's why behaviorists, we do care about the physiology and so on, because that provides texture for understanding the whys in a lot of the cases. So the hows, because these are all mechanistic for sure, but then also the whys, because in order for these mechanisms to work, it often means they're really costly, which means you have to pay the costs, which means you have the ability to pay the costs, which means you've got some behavior that's allowing you to do that. So, and so on and so forth. Okay, so genomic stuff, that's Unit B. So behavioral genetics, behavioral genomics. So again, this is kind of what it looks like on Canvas. I don't have a term sheet available for Unit B. I'll try to get one available, but you can go to these. I mean, really this set of lecture slides, all of the important terms I've tried to put in the highlights. So this highlights reel, which is available on Canvas, is like itself a term sheet. So like important terms, right there, gene, allele, genotype, character, trait, phenotype. Super important terms to know and to know the difference between nature versus nurture, G by E to P. If I were to say G by E to P, know what all three of those things mean. Genotype by environment to phenotype, the process of expression. Sometimes referred to gene expression, sometimes referred to phenotypic expression, but how do you get the phenotype? It doesn't just come from the genes, it comes from both. And that's the interesting thing about it is it can start with the genes, but if you got genes that have a really, really beneficial phenotype, you're going to purge all the other genes from the population. And then all the variation from the phenotype is actually going to come not from the genes anymore, but from the environment. And so that's like that idea that highly, strong selective pressure gets rid of heritability. Of course, the genes are still being expressed. You wouldn't get that phenotype without that genotype, but the variation in the phenotype is not coming from variation in the genes anymore, because now all that's left over is environment. And that's why we have heritability. So that's where this term of heritability comes from. Epistasis, it's not just the interactions with environment, it's interaction with other genes. So, that's a good term to know. And then finally getting to that heritability. Yep. Now, I mean, I've never asked you to calculate a heritability, and I won't. So you could imagine that in a more quantitative class, I could give you a data set and you would plot a regression line and calculate the slope of that regression line and calculate heritability. That's outside of the scope of this class. And so, and you wouldn't do that with a calculator anyway. No, this is a conceptual idea that the heritability is the proportion of variance in phenotype that's accounted for by variance in genotype. You need to know that concept, but you're not going to calculate H squared, little h or big H squared. Any questions about heritability? This idea that heritability gets selected out of a population over time. Yeah. Well, so that was me saying that the other genes create a kind of microenvironment. So it's like before it was G by E, but epistasis is saying that just like the environment modulates the gene to give you phenotype, part of the environment in epistasis is other genes that aren't directly related to that phenotype. And so that's just me sort of saying it's still kind of G by E, but now the E actually picks up a little bit of the other G's. Those parentheses, those were just meant to kind of help highlight a concept. But like when people talk about epistasis, they don't talk about the parentheses. They say G by G by E. That's just kind of our shorthand for epistasis. So yeah, that chapter we talked, oh, there's a cladogram. So this is a nice example that that in this case we've got a bunch of birds with this nest. They've got these different traits, these different ways of building their nest using glue or whatever. They've got a cladogram that has been established through other methods that and then using that cladogram, which sort of gives you hopefully reliable information about how closely related these different species are, we can then evaluate whether we think certain behavioral phenotypes kind of are a part of the whole group that might have been dropped in a handful or evolved later as a special adaptation for certain subgroups. That's all I'm kind of looking for how to interpret these things. Okay, so any questions now that we got that cladogram up there? And then that's very similar to what we were talking about here with the chronogram. And then quantitative traits. So in behavior, it's very rare that we have these candidate genes that we can say that is the gene for this behavior because behavior is really complex. Behavior is much more fit into this quantitative trait idea, where a phenotypic character is a continuous distribution. So, you know, there's spectrums. You can be, you're not just mean or nice, you're a little mean or a little nice. So, you know, you sit on a spectrum, and that, you know, behavioral spectrum, there are a wide variety of genes which, and the environment, which contribute to whether you're, you know, somewhat mean or somewhat nice. And that's just all that's kind of quantitative genetics gets into, is this idea that you're going to have a phenotypic trait with variance, and that variance is going to be generated by variance in the environment. Whether, you know, you might be mean because you don't actually get a lot of food, you know, and so if you were just, you're hungry all the time, that's what makes you mean. And if you weren't hungry, you wouldn't be mean. That's what we mean by environmental effects. But there's also could be variants in different genes. And so you might have more of one gene, like gene duplications, than others. So there's all these different sources of variation. And the big point here is there's multiple genes or multiple areas of the genome that contribute to this behavior. And quantitative genetics is all about finding where in the genome, or where in the genotype, are all these areas that contribute to this particular trait. So it's not about finding the one gene and its alleles, it's about finding the potentially many different locations which together impact the trait in different ways. This 10% comes from here, 20% comes from here, 40% from here, and so on. So that's what we mean by quantitative. So any questions, what we mean by quantitative traits and quantitative genetics? Yeah. So understand that in these highlight slides, I grabbed slides that were part of other presentations that I felt captured an important point in those presentations. They're meant to be evocative, to sort of say, ah, I understood that point on that slide. If there's something on here that you say, that's not quite as clear for me, I would recommend going back to the actual presentation to see the context. So I'm not putting these behind me to say, this is the exam. The exam is about those learning outcomes. And this is just meant to guide you to where you should study. I think the topics on these slides are important. And I just gave you the reason why I talked about these, that green box and those three blue boxes. And so I'm saying, understand that there's variation that comes from those boxes. And if you need more information for that, I definitely recommend going back, either emailing me or contacting me, or going back to this unit B to find out more about that. Okay. Evolutionary and population, you know, the term ecotype is important. Definitely imagine scenarios on the exam where I say, here is an organism that has two different ecotypes, and we need to figure out whether the differences in the traits of these two different ecotypes are due to their genes or just the fact that they live in different environments. And we talked about different behavioral methods to do that, that do that. So, you know, that's why, you know, the term ecotype and this G by E and separating those are definitely an important thing. And, you know, there's a couple of interesting terms. We talk about the handicap principle now a lot. You know, there are some other things like correlated characteristics. I think we've started to see those, you know, show up. You're starting to see a little bit more that there are certain traits that, you know, a lot of what we've talked about in the communication chapter, how you can get this engine for extreme sexual dimorphism. But there's also a bunch of traits you see in one sex that don't seem to have any function. And so that's kind of the opposite of that. That's these anticorrelated characteristics. And so, you know, part of what we need to ask is when we see a trait in a male, before we can just say, oh, the male's not doing anything with that, we maybe need to test for that. Maybe need to do behavioral experiments for that. So, you know, knowing about some of these things, like these are other reasons why you're not just going to get the dominance of one trait. You know, that's what I'm kind of driving through here. And then, you know, going back to the quantitative trait stuff, there's candidate gene stuff, but I mentioned to you, it's, you know, there are ways that you can knock out individual genes to test for individual genes, but The things get a little more complicated. We have epigenetics, so it's not always about the gene, and then we have that quantitative trait stuff. So know about epigenetics, like know that that exists, that there are things other than genes that could be turning on and off the effect of genes, and behavioral genetics. These, like I mentioned with the ecotypes, we might do cross-fostering experiments to sort of better understand the effect of G and E. Like if I take an egg from one bird and give it to another bird to raise, and it turns out exactly like the new bird, then I know it's probably very much E. If it turns out exactly like the old bird, it's probably a lot of G. In reality, some traits are going to probably be like the old bird, some traits are going to be like the new bird, and then we'll say, well, these traits, it's more G, with these traits, it's more E, and so on. So cross-fostering, there's a bunch of interesting experiments we talked about. These are just examples. I don't want you to memorize the examples. I want you to know what cross-fostering is, and I'm hoping the examples will help solidify that. So that's just me talking about this example. Twin studies, it's another way that we can separate G by E by studying the difference between these dizygotic and monozygotic twins, so kind of identical and non-identical fraternal twins. So think about how might that be useful to separate G by E. And then common gardening, a very common, transplant experiments, a very common way to also, especially with ecotypes, you've got, an organism from one part of the world that is an ecotype for a species, an organism that another ecotype of that same species in another part of the world. Let's all bring them and raise them in a laboratory where we can control everything and see, do they maintain their individuality or do they start looking like each other? That's a way we get by G by E. Common gardening. Right. That's the term. It's otherwise known as transplant experiments, but basically putting them all in a common garden. So you've taken two that in their natural environment, they show differences. Are they due to the environment or to the gene? Well, let's just raise them in a common environment and see if the differences go away. Common gardening. So yeah, these methods, know that these three methods exist. These are our behavioral methods, our non-genetic methods. But then also, we did talk about, that there's also QTL, figuring out exactly where things live. Measuring heritability is how we kind of getting to this QTL stuff. I'm not going to have you calculate heritability, but know, that high heritability means that if there's a lot of variation in the genotype, those variants that are sort of on one edge of the genotypic variation are going to very predictably be one on one edge of the phenotypic variation and vice versa. That's what it means to be heritable. Highly heritable traits are the ones that you can breed from, because that if you want to select ones that are like this, you're effectively selecting their genes, and then you can sort of affect the gene pool. But if they're low heritability, then you can't breed from that because the variation in phenotype has no relation to genotype. So if you grab an individual that's on this edge of the phenotype, their offspring won't necessarily be on this edge of the phenotype. Their offspring could be anywhere. So that's what we mean by is a trait heritable, and it's all based on the population. Heritability is a property of a population. So within this population, what's the relationship between delta P and delta G? It's a sort of important concept. So that's what we're sort of saying here. Don't worry about non-additive. We only are going to talk about, if I talk about heritability, I'm going to talk about it in the additive sense, the little h squared sense. To know the difference between these things don't really matter at this point, but I just had to introduce those because the type of heritability we talk about technically is a special type of heritability that only is this additive genetic variance. But that only really matters once you actually do start calculating things out. So this, don't worry about the big H squared, but it's this little h squared. That's the heritability that we talk about in this class. The difference between broad sense and narrow sense heritability, I'm not going to ask you about that. That won't be on the exam. But this does show, again, a way to measure little h squared is if you plot mid-parent height, the average between the parents' heights, against height and the offspring, If there's no relationship, there's no heritability. If there's a strong relationship, there's heritability. So that is a easy way for us to measure heritability. And so we can know certain traits in the same animal, in the same population, certain traits might be heritable, other traits might not be. The ones that are less heritable are more likely to have been under selection. The ones that are highly heritable are less likely to be important. Because if they were important, then those that were on one side of the variation would likely have an advantage, and then gradually that heritability go away. So if we're at equilibrium, then heritability tells us a lot about the likely selective pressures in that population. So that's heritability, and that's what I'm just saying right here. So if we have some idea that of whether the population is in equilibrium or not, and we have some heritability idea, then we have a way to guess about how important, how functional that trait is. If it's highly heritable and we think the population's in equilibrium, it probably isn't providing a lot of function, that variation. So it doesn't really matter that some individuals are green and some individuals are blue. If green and blue is highly heritable and there's just a bunch of green and blue in the population, apparently it doesn't matter if you're green or blue, you're doing just as well. Okay. So, the Hardy Weinberg, I didn't, I'm not expecting you to know, P squared, Q, like to actually know the Hardy Weinberg that you'd calculate in genetics in 340. It's great if you do, you might have a but more comfortable. But just the idea, though, that there is a theoretical concept of if you got rid of all of the evolutionary pressures and let a population just sort itself out, then what would it come to equilibrium at? And that's the Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium. And you can measure, there are techniques where you can measure how far away you are from Hardy-Weinberg. And if you're close to it, then you might assume that population is at equilibrium. If you're very far away from it, then you could say, we noticed that there was a highly heritable trait, but we can't conclude that it's not under strong selection because right now we, there might have been a giant migration event. And a bunch of individuals with, introduced a new genetic diversity, and we just were here after that migration event, and that's, so the population is out of equilibrium, and we're going to have to wait several generations to see how things sort of sort themselves out. So that's kind of what we mean, and so that's as much as I want you to know about Hardy Weinberg, and then we finally get back to the QTL, and so this idea of that along a genome, you're going to have a bunch of different spots that are going to have different effects on a trait. And some will have larger effects and some will have smaller effects, but there's no one gene. There's just a combination of genes, some more important than others, that go into a trait. And what quantitative genetics does is it tries to then use things like this QTL mapping. And you don't need to know how all of QTL mapping works. I gave you this info so that you can sort of understand the mechanisms there. But the big thing is if you can understand this, if this plot makes sense to you, you are where I want you to be. It's wonderful if you could, if somebody would say, well, how do you generate that plot? And then you were able to then talk about, well, you have to establish these markers and then you can follow these markers through breeding experiments. That's the other thing I'd like you to know is that QTL requires breeding individuals with known traits and looking at the difference between, and I think we've got that here in a second here. No, so it like, this is another one I'd want you to know is that you've got two individuals, two parents with different traits that generate offspring that have variations in those two traits. And the key idea behind QTL is you can follow the markers in the genome and you can follow the traits and correlate them together to generate that plot that I originally said that that's the thing I really want you to know. If you know, if you can tell me QTL uses breeding experiments to figure out the relative importance of different trait locus, two trait loci, that's great. That's where I want you to be. If you remember all the details about markers and linkage maps, I'm not going to ask you, it might be in the term list of a term we talked about, but I'm not going to ask you about linkage maps on the midterm. But I might ask you about the general idea of breeding experiments in QTL. So that's what we're talking about here. We breed, we look at the correlation, and we get this thing right here. So this, yeah, that's like this right here. That's a good slide. That's what you need to know about QTL. And then the other side of it is when you can't do breeding, there's this alternative GWAS, where if you have tons of individuals, then you throw all, and you've got all tons of data about each individual. You throw all their genomic data, high resolution genomic data, into a big database. Then you look for correlations between traits and different spots along the genome. And then those, give you ideas of where the kind of hot spots along the genome are for these particular traits. So you get a similar picture out from QTL, but you don't have to use breeding. You just need a lot of data, a lot of individuals, and a lot of data on each individual. So just knowing that the difference between those two, I think I've got a little summary slide here. That's a good slide right there. If you can look at that slide and understand that slide, you're in really good shape coming out of this class. Okay. So any questions about that? Behavioral genetics. The big point of that unit was those three behavioral methods: common gardening, twin studies, cross-fostering, and this. That's behavioral genetics right there. That's the behavior side of it, the molecular side of it. Done. Okay. C, learning and cognition. Again, that's on Canvas. I will again try to get a term list up there. But we talked about these motivations, why do animals learn it? This is sort of a generic idea of how different questions inform the others. But what I do want to get to, because I revised it a little bit because there were some questions, is the stuff about drive theory. And I added a few revisions to these slides, and I've updated them in the main slides as well to make this a little clearer. But yeah, learned behaviors is plasticity in contrast with innate. Learning curves, like the same stuff we had on UCEC about can you tell the difference between a learning curve and a forgetting or extinction curve? Those are good things to know. Know that neurons are involved, and know that there are short-term and long-term memory. And I don't care if you remember all the mechanisms here, but the key thing is that not only are there functional differences between short-term and long-term memory, but there are potentially energetic differences. So sometimes it's good or bad to have short-term memory. Like sometimes you really need to remember something for a long time. There are other things you should forget because they're not useful. And if you keep going back to that area to look for food, it won't be there ever again. So there are functional reasons why short-term and long-term memory will be good or bad. There are more mechanistic reasons why it's more costly or less costly. Same thing with long-term memory. So just know that there is a mechanistic reason why these things might differ in energetic cost, and there are functional reasons. So this is the slide about those memory things here, that you've got things that work on the shortest time scale, like short-term memory. If there are things in the environment that change frequently, but you need to know them for a little amount of time, that's good for short-term memory. As things get more stable in the environment, you can commit them to long-term memory. But that becomes more costly to maintain. But if they're super stable over generational time scales, then it becomes much cheaper to deal with because you can just encode them in your genes and get rid of the plasticity entirely. That's what this plot is here. So, any questions about the spectrum behind me? Does that make sense? That's the big innate versus learned slide. And the different types of learning, this is like Psych 101 stuff. So, imprinting, non-associative learning, associative learning. So, imprinting, critical time in the environment, critical signal, then learn it forever. The habituation, sensitization, habituation is about losing a response, sensitization is about getting it back. You have this example here. If you touch the animal, initially it will respond to that touch. It'll close up, but over time it eventually will open back up because it just realizes that there's no value to this stimuli. But then if you really whack the animal, then it wakes up. And then after that, if you start touching it again, it's responsive again. You have to wait for it to habituate again. So, it's a way to filter out attention. So it's all about really attention there. And then conditioning, operant versus classical. Classical conditioning, you're copying. So you have something that's already there. The unconditioned stimulus generates the unconditioned response. So by pairing it with a new stimulus, the conditioned stimulus, then you create a new mapping from conditioned stimulus to the same response. The conditioned response is the unconditioned response, but it's a response to the conditioned stimulus. That's why it's called the conditioned response. But it's the same during the experiment while you're pairing them, it's the same behavior. But then after pairing, you can give them the conditioned stimulus and they'll do the now conditioned response. That's the reason why they have different names. So there's really like three things here, not four, but we have four names for them. And this, before we do the pairing, we refer to as the neutral stimulus. So it's something you don't respond to. It's neutral. So any questions about conditioning, classical conditioning here? Yep. Well, it's not that they're seeing another. It's not imitation learning. So that's something we haven't talked about in the class. That's a form of social learning where if I see you do something, then I go and do that. The organism isn't, it's we're not demonstrating it to the organism. The organism has a behavioral response. We give them an odor, something, they would give them something to look at. We play a sound. And already when they play the sound, then they stick out their tongue or they raise their arm or something like that. And then whenever we play that sound, we now also pipe in an odor, play a different sound as well, visual and something like that. We add something that before, whenever you showed the animal this thing, it was neutral. It didn't do anything. But now, because it pairs it and it learns that this relationship between unconditioned and that response, now it copies that relationship in its head to this new stimulus. So that's what I mean by copying. So this is like when when you do dog training, if your dog already does something, like if whenever I raise my hand, Dexter sits, then I will start saying sit. And initially he's not going to remember, but over time I can stop doing this and I just say sit and he sits. That's what I mean by copying it. He always knew how to sit. He started out knowing how to sit when I did this because originally I had a treat. And when I did this, then sitting was his way of localizing that treat. So I got him to sit that way. But then now that he's done that, I can take the treat away and just use my hand. That's sort of one example of it. And then I can then go from my hand to my voice. That's another example. So we keep copying the behavior. We had to get the behavior first, and that's the next slide, I think. But once we got it there, we can then move to different stimuli. That's classical conditioning. Great. And then, so operant conditioning, like I said, how do you get the response to start with? And so that, an operant is a behavior that results in a consequence that can be learned. So when the animal does something random, you eventually reward them when they do a certain thing that you want them to do, and then they start doing that more often. So that change in the frequency of behaviors, an evolution of behaviors, if you will, that is operant conditioning. And so we can give them reinforcement or punishment, and we can do that either by adding stimuli or taking stimuli away. So increasing the frequency of behavior is reinforcement, decreasing the frequency of behavior is punishment. How we apply the punishment and reinforcement, that is, we could make it really nice for them, except when they do a behavior we don't want them to do, and we could take away the nice thing. That's an example of a negative. So that's a negative punishment because we're punishing them. We want them to stop doing that. And we do that by taking the good thing away, as opposed to positive reinforcement, where when they do the thing we want them to do, then we treat them for that. So you can have positive and negative reinforcement and positive and negative punishment. So any questions about that? Yeah. Yes. Positive. Positive punishment is I'm adding an aversive stimulus when something bad happens. Great. Okay. And then we can then talk about when we're, some animals will be prepared. They already do the thing. We just are trying to get them to do it more. Unprepared, they've never done that before. Contra-prepared, what they would do in nature is opposite to what we want them to do. And that's going to change how quickly or the ability of them to learn. Okay. So those are our three right here. We can use them as lenses out in nature. These are really good for building laboratory experiments in order to test learning. Out in nature, it's a much more complicated mix of learning that goes on. We can use them as lenses to try to understand what's going on in nature, but not every example in nature is going to fit one of these paradigms. So, that don't think that it has to. So yeah, that's what I was saying. Like dog training technically is a combination of those two. Trial and error learning looks a lot like operant conditioning, but there are a bunch of other things like taste aversion learning. It doesn't quite fit, and it turns out it's something totally different. So that's what we're saying here. Then there are interesting learning behaviors you can find in caching. And the big question is, are the squirrels, the tree squirrels, actually learning, or are they using cues in the environment? So that's what we talked a lot about that. Different ways that you could cache, different ways that you could steal from cachers. So that's the, reminder that social learning, basic models of learning. There we go. That's all I was saying kind of earlier. And then drive theory. And I'll rush to get to, because there was a little confusion here about redirected and displacement behavior. I just want to make it clear that redirected behavior is the idea that an animal wants to do a behavior. It doesn't have the object that it would like to do the behavior to. So then it redirects it to another object in the environment, a physical object, a person, a place, a thing. Another object gets something. That's the redirected behavior. This is a little different than displacement behavior, where you get this irrelevant behavior often because you have a conflict between two things. So in this case, you cannot do the intended behavior. There is no mate around. So instead, you just direct all your energy into destroying a nearby fence. Here, very often you can do that, like you can do two behaviors. You could, get closer to mom or get closer to friends playing. But there's a trade-off that if you go play with your friends, you're out of the safety of mom. If you go stick with mom, you can't play with your friends. You can do both of those, but because there's this conflict, then you end up doing something in between, which is like you pick your nails because you're nervous because you can't figure out which of these two things to do. And so that is what we mean by a displacement behavior. It's something that you potentially could do other things, and then you get displaced. And that's kind of what we talked about here. That can turn in to these really repetitive stereotype behaviors that are not only irrelevant, but they can get pathologically harmful. And a lot of those are self-directed. All right, I won't keep you any longer. If you have any questions, please feel free to come up afterwards. Otherwise, I'll let you know about the availability windows via Canvas announcement. And good luck if I don't see you. Okay. Okay. Oh, right. I send me a note. I don't have a problem, I think, with allowing the iPad for this one. I just have to turn that on. Otherwise, there's also computer labs you're free to use, but send me a note and I'll think about it and yeah. That's right. You are free. Either one. All week next week, you can take it wherever you like. Yes.
Dog and
Yep.
that's positive.
You're adding the water, which it doesn't like, to get it to stop barking. Yes. Negative. Okay. All right, yeah, negative would be like if Dexter was standing right here and he's sitting in place and I keep giving him treats while he's sitting there, and then he stands up and then I take the treats away. Yeah, so that would be, yeah, it's I'm taking a stimulus away. I'm making it a little worse for him in order to get him to stop standing. Yeah. Okay, sure. Sure, let me go ahead and stop the recording here since this will potentially is personal.
Thank you.